The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
You know, China and Germany will sell you hundreds of billions of dollars worth of steel and put you out of business, but then you can go over there and get them to do current default swaps on sovereign debt in Italy and Portugal. That's what was going on. That's what was going on here. And now enough people have understood that, you know what, we got real problems here. And you're right, we're making the adjustment, and it's going to hit other countries.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. As we talked about last week, we have Bill King on the show today, usually after a Fed action and especially after what Draghi talked about last Thursday. We wanted to have Bill King on because he looks at the tick-by-tick types of changes in the market. And honestly, after, what does he have, 40, 45 years of experience, this guy's had to learn the hard way, you know, how to work in the market.
But there's a contrast between knowing the significance of what's happening in volumes and with the internals of the market, and as you say, a tick-by-tick awareness of behavioral change. Bill brings something else to the equation here, and it is that he sees the big picture changing, and he's got enough time in the markets to know what some of the sort of zeitgeist shifts are, the major worldview pictorial changes, whether it's politics, geopolitics. And I think it gives him a significant leg up.
I would call him a street smart historian is what he is. I mean, he's street smart. You'll hear it when you listen to him. He's a regular on the show. But this conversation is probably going to go long enough. We will break this into two programs. So this is part one of a two-part show. Be sure to listen next week for the rest of it.
Bill, great to have you back with us on the program. You know, in the last week or so, we've had a lot of activity with your central banks, both the Fed and its announcement of taking rates one step higher, and then the ECB intimating some tightening as well as we move towards year end. So rates in the tightening cycle. Again, last week, the Fed raised rates. You had the old adage, three steps and then a stumble. Here we are with seven. Are we dealing with new rules, a new era, or maybe just a new step sequence? What do you think?
Well, you know, I don't know if it's new rules in a larger context. It's probably new rules for the people that have only had 10 years or less experience in the industry or in, you know, managing their own money. You know, that's the problem. We used to have normal cycles. You know, you go back historically, you always said they talked about the four-year business cycle. And some would also see a three-year, and they'd kind of lace them together, and then kind of correlated with the political cycle. And obviously, it had to do with central banks. Central banks raised rates when they thought, usually two things, if inflation was picking up or they saw the inventory cycle picking up. And then, of course, everything got distorted and perverted over the last 20 to 30 years, led by Alan Greenspan here, who just thought he could generate prosperity for everybody by juicing the stock market and assets up. And, of course, Bernanke continued that, and as did Yellen, and now we've got a difference. So I think part of this is you have 10 years of a runaway bull market. Some people call it the everything bubble, you know, the bonds, the whole thing. But the bonds have been reacting for over a year. You could just go back and look at charts, how they based and they've been turning up. And people really weren't paying that much attention because the stocks kept going up. But what's interesting, if you do look at the stock prices, 2016, things started rolling over. There was no question. And you could look and see some of the longer term, if you look longer term charts, into the weeklies and the monthlies on the S&P and everything, it was ready to correct and go down. And then, of course, what happened, we had this major disruption, and that's not pun intended, when Trump won the election. You had this surge, and then you had this mania about the tax cuts, and that really pulled stocks out of harm's way. And again, you can go back, if anyone wants to do a technical look, stocks were in big trouble at that time. And you can see what has happened on other charts and commodities and whatever. And now we're going through, after that surge since January, we're kind of going through a consolidation in stocks because enough people are figuring out what's going on. That is that the Fed is being serious here about raising rates. You know, people were talking before, is it going to be two or three? And then it became, is it three or four rate hikes in 2018? And then in the first quarter, we had some weak economic data. And everybody started saying, oh, no, there's only going to be three. And if you looked at the Fed Fund futures, they were projecting a very small chance of a hike in December. Now, what's interesting here is the U.S. economic bean counters, besides their usual craftiness, have had real difficulty since 2008 because the seasonal adjustments, especially for the first quarter, because remember when everything hit the fan there, it started falling apart in when Lehman went down in September, but it was really the fourth quarter in 2008 when the whole system just went to hell and we were really at the door. The deflation, you saw everything. You saw when gold just, everything collapsed there except, you know, the bonds ran up. And that kind of continued. The stocks finally bottomed, I believe, in February of 2009. The economy bottomed a little later. But the point being is you had such horrible GDP numbers and employment numbers and everything in the first quarter that the seasonal adjustments were distorted for a long time. Now, if you remember, as we went forward for a few years, remember we had the polar vortex, then we had another problem, the snowstorms, and you kept getting these horrible Q1 GDP numbers. And it's been continuing for a while where we get really ugly GDP in Q1. And then all of a sudden things pick up in the second quarter. And, you know, I've been saying this and in our letter here, is you look at the retail sales and all these numbers that were really soft in Q1, didn't mesh with what you saw in consumer sentiment numbers. It also didn't see it with some of the tax data that was coming through. Now, all of a sudden today, we get this big boost in retail sales for May, double what was expected, 0.8. Ex-autos was even stronger, 0.9. And if people have been paying attention, this is kind of what we've been seeing the last few years, is you're getting soft Q1 readings in the economy. Then all of a sudden, it starts getting boosted in Q2 and the rest of the year. And I'm convinced it has to do because we've got the seasonal adjustments all messed up. So with that, what we're getting now is you see the stock market reacted a couple months ago where it started rallying. You know, we peaked in late January. Everything started rolling over. The only thing that ran up was the NASDAQ because people ran to the FANG stocks and the Uber capital tech stocks. And that pushed those to all-time highs. And then we had the Russell going up because that was where you hit if you were worried about the trade. You knew the big multinational, the Dow stocks, would have a problem if Trump was having this trade fight, so you ran to that. But the stocks, by and large, have been trending water here. We got the rally, though, after you had that VIX crash in February. You saw it. You could look at the charts. Then we have a nice rally in April and May because the economy was picking up, or they thought it was picking up. At least the data was showing that. And now you're seeing here is afterward, people are starting to understand that the second quarter is going to look very good. Now stocks are pausing here again. And maybe it's because the good news has been digested with North Korea, with also with the economy. But what happened with the Fed minutes yesterday is it kind of put the fourth rate hike this year, December, firmly on the table. Before, people were questioning that because of the downturn, and some were even questioning the September hike. Most people thought the Fed was locked in on June because they had made such a big deal. But now that the economy is picking up, and today's retail sales growth, most economists are all saying that this is consistent with 4% or higher GDP growth with the retail and the consumption numbers that have been showing up in here. So now you're going to have more than likely 4 rate hikes. In fact, now you're almost at 50% for December for the fourth hike, which is almost double what it had been just a couple, 3 weeks ago. So you can see what's going on here, and that's what the market's trying to figure out. Even today, you can see these mixed markets the last few days, and we're really just chopping around, trading sideways. You get a little burst here, a little burst there. And the thing you're fighting also is you've got a new Fed, and what a very small number of people recognized yesterday is we know there's a tone change going on with rate hikes, and people are seeing that and they understand, but they don't understand you've got a new chairman at the Fed, Powell. And I saw a few guys on Wall Street took some shot at him saying, well, he's not an academic. Well, my view is, thank God. We haven't had a real Fed chairman since Volcker, who was not an academic. He was a banker. You know, we got the other three Jamokes in there who were academics, and they screwed up so bad it's not funny. And that's what's interesting here with Powell. And if you listen to him yesterday, a few people saw his remarks, saw the Fed, and they're saying this is different. Now, one of the things that was really different is this was a very brief communique, almost half of what normally is said, which, again, is academics like to run their mouths. We all know that, try to show everybody how smart they are. This guy's not doing that, and this guy is concerned about inflation, and he's taking measured steps in here. So that's another reason why people are going, oh, okay, we're going to get that fourth rate hike in here, and now they're projecting 3 rate hikes in 2019. So people are starting, after the 3 doves we had, super doves in all honesty, historic doves going all the way back to Greenspan and came in August 1987. So you had 31 years of these guys Now you got somebody in here who, you can't call him Volcker, but is acting like he's a serious central banker that is not here to facilitate Wall Street, but is here with a plan for the future, an economic future, and he understands that you can't really react to data. You have to anticipate because you're aiming at a moving target. So this is long-winded, I understand, but I don't think enough people in the market understand that this is a real change, not just because they're hiking rates, they've done seven, but you've got new stewardship at the Fed, and it certainly is giving the appearance of being a different sheriff than the previous three. So I think that's why you're seeing, you know, the dollar started moving up strongly in April. If you go back, you see, and again, this is part of the Forex markets being usually the smartest market, understanding that the U.S. economy, the data was going to show better. I hesitate to say the economy is doing better because I think the economy is doing fine in the first quarter. It's just the data was understating it. And I don't think the economy has really accelerated that much here in the second. It's just because this seasonal adjustment, some of these other things, you're norming it out. So you're getting the stronger dollar rally, especially today, because the ECB was so dovish here on Thursday, and so was Draghi. So you could see this kind of building in here. And the surprise to me here is gold is rallying after the ECB with the strength in the dollar in here. That, to me, is kind of a condemnation of Europe in here and what they're doing. So very interesting. We're seeing it how the market's adjusting to really new stewardship at the Fed. And if this keeps playing the way it is, somewhere the stocks are going to have a real reckoning because the ECB is, there's several articles show up that they're the main focus now for traders in the market. And they've been supplying, and the ECB's balance sheet just hit a record because they keep doing the QE in here. But at some point, and it appears we're getting it now, is that the Fed's seriousness against the profligacy of Draghi and ECB is starting to end. Now, the bigger concern, and again, it'll probably start showing up in fall, is that Draghi's only got 6 months left, right? He's done at the end of the year. And right now, it looks like Weidmann or one of the Germans is the favorite to take over. If that happens, look out. Because they've been talking for years that they don't like the negative rates. You're killing the German savers. You know, this is not good for us politically, yada, yada, yada. And if that happens, that's going to be a real problem. And we should know more when you get into the late fall, you know, the critical time around August and November when stocks tend to retrench here after summer rallies, because by that time, we should have a better understanding who's going to take over at the ECB. And that should produce a sizable reaction here in the market. So, bottom line, right now with the Fed hiking rates, people that are patient, the smart people, the big money, the big private money, even smart institutions, understand that when the Fed's cutting rates and they're easy money, which was most of the last 10 years, they're forcing you to buy something. Stocks, gold, oil, real estate, baseball cards, they're just forcing you. But once the Fed starts hiking rates, especially after they've done a couple rates, you start moving rates up a bit, all of a sudden they're paying you to watch. So before you're being penalized, when you're holding cash and the rates are going against you. Now, you're not being penalized as much. In fact, you're getting up here over 2% in six-month CDs and T-bills, et cetera, in here. So now, all of a sudden, you can be more patient. And you can see that. You can see it in the gold. You can see it in some of these, even in some of the stocks, whatever, here, is as this keeps playing here, people with patience, more people can have patience and wait and watch this play out.
You know, as we watch the dollar strengthen in a rising rate environment, we reflect on kind of the knock-on effects. And maybe there's some things from past tightening cycles that are relevant, but emerging market stress increases as the dollar has moved to the mid-90s. We've already seen that. What does it look like if the dollar accelerates to the upside and heads towards, say, 102, 103, that range? What does that spell for the emerging markets?
Well, it hurts because emerging markets, by definition, are in debt, right? Because they're emerging, they're developing. Just like a developing business, you tend to have a significant amount of debt because you're emerging. You haven't built up the cash. And most debt is denominated in dollars. And that's why you saw, in again, in the fourth quarter of 2008, the dollar went berserk. Because if you're in debt and you're in dollar-denominated debt, you're short the dollar. So people in debt, dollar debt, when the dollar starts going up, it's by foreigners, not the U.S. people, because your income is in dollar. But the people in emerging markets, that means their receipts that, you know, they're getting, they're generating, unless it's in dollars, they can't keep up with the dollar payment. They're losing. So every time the dollar goes up 5%, their dollar debt is going up approximately 5%. And that's where the squeeze becomes, is a debt squeeze. And you see today, which is interesting to me here on the last few weeks, and it's continuing in here after the Fed and the ECB meetings, is the U.S. big banks are getting hit. And if you remember, for the last two quarters, you had the same fools on Wall Street that were telling everybody the market was going to go down 30% if Trump was elected, we're going to go into depression. We're telling people, oh, you buy bank stocks when rates go up, which was funny because if you look, that's when you're supposed to buy banks, when rates go down. So what are they telling you here? You always buy banks? And the banks are getting hit, and they're getting hit pretty good, and they've been struggling. They get a little rally here or there, you know, pop up when they get at a wide divergence between other S&P groups. You'll see some of the quant guys come in. But you can see there's pressure on the banks, and that is very, very important because this stock market, it can go up for a while, but it can't go up meaningfully for meaningful periods of time when your financial stocks are deteriorating, and they are. And, you know, I think we produced a chart a week or so ago showing this enormous spread between the FANG stocks and the bank stocks. You know, and the FANGs, again, are the trading sardines. They also have some safe haven play because they have so much cash, they act like convertible bonds. But with the banks deteriorating, they're telling you just what you alluded to, that there's something going on here with emerging markets and other people that are in debt. Again, when the dollar goes up, people in debt are getting squeezed. And that's kind of what looks like is happening here. There is some concern in the banking sector here with what's going on here. So you did bring it. There's a great point about emerging markets and how does this fit in with the dollar rally. It does put stress on people that are in dollar-denominated debt.
So ECB has a couple of transition points. One, if September is slowing of purchases, and then by the end of the year, there's a cessation of purchases, as Draghi's recently said. First of all, who's going to be floating all boats? You know, is the Bank of Japan sufficient to do that? And does this really signal the end of a decade of easy money? You know, monetary policies have been a part of the attempt to put us on a solid footing. Are we to assume that the global economy is robust enough to handle tightening with no ill effect?
Well, you're bringing a good point here, is because with the ECB communicating with Draghi did today, is it leaked out a few weeks ago. Some of the ECB officials said, look, enough of this. We have to address this QE. It was scheduled to end in September. And when we addressed this almost a year ago, when they talked about it, their markets cratered. And it scared the heck out of them. So they said, well, we can't even talk about what we're going to do with QE because we're so fragile here. Which, when you think about it, it's so stupid, but it's also scary. If you're that fragile, you can't even talk about when we might end QE. So what the ECB did is they said, okay, we'll possibly, and that's the thing, if the data is okay, you know, that's again the qualifier, we'll end the QE in December, which means they extended it 3 months. So the ECB was more dovish. They said, we'll extend it by 15 billion euros when people thought it might be only 10. And they also project that rates won't go up until summer of 2019 when people thought it would be Q1 or Q2. And they also lowered their GDP projection for this year to 2.1 from 2.9. And then Draghi gets up and everybody expects him to be dovish, which he was. The first thing that was really that struck people was he said the ECB did not discuss when to hike rates, which is unbelievable when you think about that. And he also said you still need significant monetary stimulus. It's still needed. So he put all this together in here, and then he tries to talk out of the other side of his mouth, saying, what happened to this slowdown we're having? It's only temporary. There's just some special factors in here, and there's some uncertainty about trade, and there's some supply constraints. But the data in the Eurozone has been really deteriorating. And just a couple days ago, you had the industrial production down 0.9%, which is more than double what they were expecting. We know Italy's a problem, Spain, Portugal, you know, you can go through that whole list. That's not surprising anybody. What people fail to understand is, you go back to 2004, 5 in that area, Germany was in deep trouble. And we all know Germany is sustaining the whole Eurozone here. Now, you did get some help from the northern countries when oil went berserk. And Norway, Finland, you know, money poured into them and their sovereign wealth funds because the energy went berserk there in 2010-11 and money poured in. But Germany, by and large, just carried Europe. And the reason they went from a basket case to this big engine was because China and other emerging markets purchased machine tools like crazy from them because they were industrialized. Now the problem has become, and there's a few economists and a few other people, the analysts have pointed this out over the last 6 months or so, that China and emerging markets went from their biggest customers to their competitors. Because once China bought all these machine tools and all this know-how and technology, just what they do with the U.S., they turn around and they start producing those goods. And now all of a sudden, Germany's got a problem. That first, the exports of the machine tools are slow, but now those countries are, you know, they're in competition with you. So they've got that problem. They've got the migration problem. They've got the sovereign debt problem. They're having their political revolts, as you keep seeing. Things keep popping up here. And then they quickly try to, you know, hit Brexit, and now the European Solons are, you know, have been moving to stop that. The Spain, independence, Catalonia. You saw this stuff here with Italy when the Populist Party took over, couldn't form a government, then they're maneuvering that. Just this constant problems in Europe that Germany can't paper over. And now you got Merkel's having problems because she's still trying to go soft on the immigration, and the conservatives are starting to threaten to pull out of her coalition. So Europe is in real trouble here. You can see their people are trying a populist revolt, but they haven't had a Trump appear yet that's going to come in and be a disruptor and restructure Europe or the individual economy. So Draghi's always thought all along he's, you know, the little boy with his fingers in the dike. He's going to be gone soon. So you're absolutely dead right bringing up Europe. I think Europe is the real problem here going forward for the next 6 months as to where can something ugly pop up that could be a catalyst for global turmoil. And I think you get your finger right on the right pulse there.
Well, so back to the six-month transition, because you're really talking about the possibility of a different kind of stewardship at the ECB, just as we're experiencing new stewardship at the Fed. And if it is Weidmann, you're really not talking about a consistent alignment of Brussels and Germany. Now you're talking about kind of going your separate ways, and, you know, it changes dynamics pretty considerably. So keep that in the backdrop for this next question, because you've got trade and tariffs and things that are emerging that are, again, five different versions of political revolts, whether it's in Europe or here in the United States, circa 2016. But does that trade and tariff fight, does it erode the deflationary effects that we've had from globalization? And does that impact and reintroduce in the next era a more strongly inflationary theme for the years ahead?
Well, what's the positive impact? See, that's the problem. The positive impact on what? On IBM? On JP Morgan? Because the globalization has killed the average American. That's why Trump's here. And it's doing the same thing now with the people in Southern Europe. So from a Wall Street-centric point, they talk globalization. I always get a kick out of this. I've been hearing this globalization since I've been in business, since 1974. And I'm thinking, well, you know, didn't Marco Polo start globalization here? Isn't that when we started? You know, you go back, it's been going on for, you know, the Knights Templar were the first international bankers. And that's what's going on here, is this whole point of what was the benefit of globalization here. There are winners in here. The point everybody tries to say is, well, they make lower costs, the goods. Yeah, but you throw people out of work. See, they've been looking at one side of the coin. You know, this was the thing. Oh, this almost like Darwinian. Oh, the selective advantage people that produce. The problem is, we throw those people on welfare, or as they've been going here, jobless claims. But then when they get exhausted, they go get a doctor, write up a disability. So we lose jobs. We put people on welfare or some freebie of the government, and they can keep buying goods. And that's what's perverted the classical theory here. Because if people all fell out of work, they couldn't buy goods from China and Japan, and the currencies would readjust. So what do? Is we give people the money to buy the goods. And that's what Trump understands here. And that's what the Bushes and the elitists were saying. Oh, that's okay. We can keep lowering the price of goods. Yeah, because we keep throwing people out of work and we keep giving them the money to buy the goods. So you don't get the natural adjustment. That's what's going on for four decades of these trade problems. So that's why we have $20 trillion in debt. Because we keep taking money to give people so you can keep buying stuff. You can go to Walmart and buy all the Chinese goods. You can go to wherever you're going, Costco or whatever. And that game has got to end. And the difference with Trump and with the other people that have been in there, they saw the problems and they said, well, let's slow walk them and let them blow up on somebody else's watch. And one of the things Trump did here, if you watch the people on the inside that talk, is he looked at the North Korea problem that started with Bush 1 and then Clinton gave them money to be good. And then, you know, same thing Bush 2, Obama, just every time they rattled their saber, we'll give them more money. And Trump looked up and said, my God, they've got nuclear weapons. They've got missile technology. We're going to have a real problem now. Now, if we go in, then we might have to do, we have a nuclear exchange. This is really bad. However, it's going to be worse if we don't address it later. And that's what he wants. And when he started moving, you can be sure that these guys, we don't know it. We'll probably learn it years later when somebody writes the book, is that when Trump and his generals, mostly Mattis, started moving certain U.S. offensive military assets and China's satellite and Russia's satellite started seeing this, plus whatever they intercepted. Plus, when Trump was talking about evacuating all U.S. citizens from South Korea, that China and Russia, as well as North Korea, understood it was going to happen. And then all of a sudden, they went from, we're going to shoot missiles at Guam and Hawaii and on your West Coast, to, okay, let's have a little peace powwow here. That's the difference. And why all of a sudden the dollar, that's part of this whole thing here, is nobody wants to address the problems. Not Japan, not Europe, but Trump is one of the guys that is, like, first time since Reagan, where he's saying, you know what, it's bad. Got to do this now, it's bad, but it'll be worse later. Which is what Bush 1 should have done with Social Security and Medicare when he had an 85% approval rating after the first Gulf War. But nobody wanted to do this. So when you get back to this globalization, he's addressing this. He said, we have $800 billion problem, and I'm addressing it now. And you know what? We can't lose because we're the ones running the deficit. And if we're going to take some short-term pain, just like if we have to take this confrontation with North Korea, we're far better off doing it and taking it now because it'll be much worse later. And that's starting to happen here. And maybe that's why the markets are getting cautious in here, because if you really thought through this, Obama said it and Trump said it. The most urgent problem U.S. had was North Korea with their nuclear program and missile technology. So once you get that done, where do you go next? Probably Iran. And then as that starts playing out here, then you're going to go for trade. Because once you start taking care of imminent national security threats, you start moving on those, the economy's doing okay now, so you can kind of get the security threats out of the way. But he's going to address this trade problem. And it is a problem. And you can't keep doing this, or you're going to blow up here. And a lot of that debt you're looking at is because people aren't working here. And again, the fallacy here that all these classical economists are making about the benefit of globalization is they're telling you the only benefit they can throw out there is it gives you lower cost goods. But what if you don't have a job? In the U.S., it's, well, okay, fine, we'll give you free money to keep buying those goods and services so our big corporations don't go bankrupt or have to make the adjustment. And that's the problem. Forget the debt side. You're destroying society. I think it was Tucker Carlson did a whole thing about how you destroyed the male population in the U.S., where you're at as far as family formation, males taking jobs, males going to college, males going into trade, because we've said, no, okay, you don't have to. Yeah, you don't have to. You don't have to work. You don't have to be responsible for your family. You don't have to do this, that, and the other. And that's the other side of the globalization that they don't want to talk about, is why not having a job, by just taking the freebie and keep buying the goods from the big U.S. corporations, that it's okay. And that's another impact in here that Trump and his people understand here. So I get Wall Street wants to talk about globalization, and it's always one benefit. Oh, yeah, cheaper goods. Aren't you happy? Well, I'd rather have a job, a good paying job, and have to pay a little more for tomatoes or cars or whatever here, than watch the debt go crazy. And now all of a sudden I'm paying, which I was, $2,000 a month for health care, but now that I'm going on Medicare, it's like a quarter of that. So I'm getting a freebie now. But Medicare is going to blow up in 2026. So you can see what the major problems are. And Trump is trying to get to that. So I know it's a long-winded, but it just fries my backside as people say the benefits of globalization. There's really only one they can point their finger at, but they will not talk about what it does to the economy and what it does as far as displacing workers, blowing up your debt, and also destroying your culture.
Those are real factors. When we look at the amount of monetary policy and the amount of credit creation that has occurred in this particular era, I think one of the reasons I'm looking for a globalization plug-in is, you know, because there hasn't been the inflationary impact that we would have had in the 60s and 70s. So, you know, debt monetization, et cetera, and is it possible that the games of labor arbitrage and things like that have somehow taken the edge off of inflation, where if we do move towards a more nationalist priority, getting the jobs back, and yes, that means people have an income, and yes, people are paying more, doesn't that reverse sort of a 30-year trend of things getting cheaper, and now things have to get more expensive, and now all of a sudden, all the central banks of the world are looking at a totally changed landscape?
Well, it depends on your country. It depends on what you're going to allow your currency to do. And you see, that's why Reagan was popular, is that people, first, the incomes went up. He eventually cut taxes. People think he came in and cut taxes. It took a while. But what happened with Reagan is your inflation just absolutely collapsed and your dollar got strong. So the average guy all of a sudden had enormous amount of more purchasing power. So if the U.S. dollar gets strong and people have jobs, those goods coming in here are going to get cheaper in here. And you're getting more purchasing power. People get more bullish, better sentiment, you know, et cetera in here. I see what you're alluding to is that some countries are going to take a hit on this. And that's probably going to be, you know, Germany, Europe, China to some degree, Japan. You're right. There's going to be a readjustment on this global order. And that's what Trump's saying is you're not going to come in here and keep throwing your garbage at us. You're not going to keep subsidizing your steel. Because he also makes the point here that Wall Street never did is China's got so much excess steel capacity and aluminum producing capacity, and you throw in the emerging markets, whatever, you can put all our industries out of business. We're done as a country because we cannot have a military base here if we don't produce steel. In a time of a crisis, if these factories can't immediately start producing what we need, we have a national security crisis. And that's the other reason why he's doing this and adjusting this. And that's why he went for the steel, aluminum, and these heavy industries. Because he's smart enough to understand this. Where your globalists were like, oh, so what? We'll just keep importing steel. Yeah, we have a war with China and they're going to give you steel. Maybe the U.S. was stupid enough to do that to Hitler in Japan in the 30s, selling them all our scrap steel and whatever so they could arm. But China's not going to do that. And I don't know who else is going to do that for us. So that's the other side of this thing, that winding back on the globalization here. And you can't just say, well, we have a service industry. And that was the other excuse for Wall Street. Well, we got great services. What do you mean? Trading mortgage-backed securities? Doing credit default swaps on subprime? How'd that work out for everybody? Is that your service industry you're talking about? You know, China and Germany will sell you hundreds of billions of dollars worth of steel and put you out of business, but then you can go over there and get them to do credit default swaps on sovereign debt in Italy and Portugal. That's what was going on. That's what was going on here. And now enough people have understood that, you know what, we got real problems here. And you're right, we're making the adjustment and it's going to hit other countries.
There's a fascinating media presentation, of course, because Trump, in terms of the trade tariff stuff, Trump is a total chump. You know, and then on the other side, you've got the GOP, who's just as happy to lob Molotov cocktails at the White House as the Democrats are. And it's just fascinating. Why does Trump catch it from every direction if strategically he's actually doing some things that are beneficial to the United States? You said first Korea, then Iran, then you tackle trade. I mean, these are things that give us a strategic advantage.
Well, I don't know if I talked about it last time we were on, but the thing that struck me with Trump, and I've never liked his persona and like the way he leads his life, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And most people don't. What was interesting to me is since Reagan, people said, gee, we should have a businessman in instead of these politicians. We're sick of politicians. And the thing is, these politicians, it's funny because I always watch the movie, you know, Charlie Wilson's War when it shows up. But he says right in there, and they're talking about people electing you. He goes, but I don't get, my people don't elect me. It's my donator. The big donors get me elected. And that's been the wisdom now for decades in Washington, that I need the big electors. I need the big hedge fund money. I need the big Hollywood money, the East Coast. And they were running the country. You know, I need those donations in here. I need the big bank. I need Wall Street's money. And Trump came in and said, no, I don't need that anymore. And I know why I don't need it, because I can use these other things here. So he's not beholding. But the thing that dawned on me with Trump is that's what politicians learn, is they have to suck up to the handful of people that give them the big money. And that's been, by and large, the people that big industrialists, big banks, and they worked for the globalization because it benefited them. And no matter what it did to the middle of America, they didn't care. But Trump was a real estate developer. And the one thing Trump knew is he couldn't be an ideologist or hunker down with an extreme. That Trump had to do research. If you're going to put your own money, hundreds of millions, if not billions, part of you going into debt, you've got to do your research. And what that means, you got to understand what the consumer wants, what the demographics are, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Otherwise, you blow up. You're gone. So the thing that dawned on me as Trump was going through this campaign, actually is the primary process, every major issue, Trump was on the side of most Americans. He was against illegal immigration. He wanted the wall. All the things that the political establishment and the mainstream media were against, and the middle America was for, there wasn't a single issue that he was on the wrong side of. He went from last in the 17 or 16 field of GOP to the top almost immediately as soon as they started the debates, because he went out there and people said, my God, you're saying what I believe. The other guys are knocking you for it. And you can see that that's the secret to Trump here, is that he is on the right side of what people want. I have no idea what he personally believes, and he doesn't care about what the big donors, he doesn't care what the establishment, he doesn't care what these other people think. He just keeps looking at what is the data. And that's how he got rich and made his money, was what do people want, doing your research, checking the demographics, whatever, and then giving the people that vehicle. If that's what he's doing with his policies now. And that's your point about the establishment. they were locked into the big money people, the big banks, the Koch brothers, the Soroses, you know, the big hedge fund guys, that what they want. And Trump said, that's wrecking the country, and we're going the other way. And he's going for Main Street over Wall Street. Now, he gave Wall Street the big break early with the big tax cut. And he said, that's it. That's all you're getting from me. And that should be enough. And that set off a bunch of things in consumers. It really, more importantly, it helped the small businesses. You see the small businesses where these really getting the big boost in here, in the sentiment, but also with you cutting rules and regulations. And that's kind of the undercurrent in the economy that people have a hard time getting their hands on. Everybody can see what the GM and Apples and whatever, but it's that small startup business, the people that you really can't measure except by tax receipts as they start coming in. But that's where his strength has been and continues to be in here.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney, and our guest today, Bill King. We'll continue that conversation next week with Bill. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.